this week, I want to put season two on hold. We will return in a fortnight with our fourth episode exploring the concept of responsibility in art, but in the meantime, I'm delighted to bring you this conversation between my co-host Jana and internationally renowned theatre critic Andrew Hayden. Andrew is a freelance writer. He writes regularly for The Guardian newspaper, Time Out London, and blogs at postcardgods.blogspot.co.uk, amongst so many other things. We haven't finished with the topic of responsibility and ethics, but we've been wanting to bring you this conversation for a long time, and now seems to be the moment. I think it's a wonderful chance to consider the topics that Jana and I are so passionate about and examine them within a global context. So enjoy this conversation between Andrew and Jana, and we'll be back in a fortnight with a brand new episode.
You know, when I first found out about your writing, so this would have been around 2008 probably, I remember this sense of enormous relief that there was someone else in the world who, who was writing in English, who was there to articulate this this frustration with theatre as it was happening in, I don't know, Anglophone countries. Mm. Let's just kind of paint them all with the same broad brush. Because you wrote a number of pieces on your blog, and then increasingly at the time in The Guardian as well. I think you had just started writing for The Guardian.
Yeah.
Where you were basically saying in various from various angles, how is it possible that here on this side of the continent there's this amazing, inventive, visually beautiful theatre, and on this other side of the same continent in the UK, we don't even know about it. It's not that we don't even know about it.
Yeah, no, it was really strange. I mean, we were having this conversation before you started recording, and we...
Breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah, radio show. We haven't just met in a studio. there was... Lynn Gardner, who's the Guardian's second string critic, was tutoring this workshop, I suppose it was, in Munich, which was attached to the Spielart Festival, and that was part of a series of 10 workshops which she basically kind of parachuted me into. So, and it was me and the executive director, I think, of Total Theatre, the organisation, is a woman called Pippa Bailey, and because Pippa has children and many, many other reasons that she can't sort of go to the continent so much, I ended up going to 8 of them, and she ended up going to two or three, I think. There was quite a lot of dance work, contemporary dance work shown, and these were all nominally theatre festivals, which I found really fascinating. And then a lot of the work would probably be most happily housed in a sort of a live art environment in London. I'm putting big inverted commas around the live art thing, because it doesn't seem to be a term that anyone else in the rest of Europe actually uses.
No.
But we needed to find a special way of talking about it in Britain, because otherwise everybody's head would have exploded if that was still theatre as well. Mm-hmm. But it is. And forced entertainment, that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah. But so, just to kind of interject here, live art is also used in a very strange way in Australia to refer to the sort of work that comes from the UK, and there's a historical reason for this, which is that in, shall we say, continental Europe, theatre opened up to experimentation quite early on. You know, like...
Yeah, although there's an interesting kind of schism where, like, Marina Abramovich, rigorously denies that she has anything to do with theatre and hates theatre because it's real. So a load of those artists do make visual art, and, you know, it's like performance art, you know, Frank O'Bee and Ron Athey and all that lot.
Yeah.
So I guess it's not a completely dumb, you know, bit of taxonomy on the part of the English, but...
No, but what happened, and I think because I've never really studied this, I've never had this explained to me, this is sort of intuitive, performance art that developed in the US came from visual arts, and this is what was called performance art, and not just performance, but in a lot of Europe, That sort of experimentation kind of entered theatre itself very early on. And this is the work of people like Pina Bausch, you know, who made dance theatre.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, dance. And so what we call, I think in Germany, like in Croatia, it's called new theatre,
mm-hmm.
rather than live art. You know, it's just considered to be another form of theatre. And then in some other places where theatre did not open so quickly, but it sort of opened to performance art, there is this thing called performance, you know, which is kind of like, which is a sort of theatre.
Yeah.
Really. And you know, specifically in Australia, funnily enough, performance, what we call performance, developed in Sydney very strongly, but not in Melbourne. In Melbourne, it only arrived as live art, imported, you know, about 5 years ago from London, where, again, it came from visual arts, but really, really late, in the 80s, sort of.
Yeah.
And then it had to be called something, had to be called something art, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is where you sort of like it is slightly different work actually because of the genealogy of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who kind of do what we call performance, like people in Sydney, sort of look at live art and are often really confused about why this is meant to be something new.
Mm. Yeah, and I realised after saying all that I also went to the New Plays from Europe Festival in Wiesbaden. Yeah, it was seeing the stuff which was being put on from main stages in Europe, which I think was probably the bigger spur to what I got maybe a bit more interested in and a bit more grumpy about in terms of how it related to Britain, because we did have a live art scene and, you know, it was that some of those artists were also turning up at these festivals, so we didn't... The live art scene doesn't feel cut off from Europe in nearly the same way, whereas seeing work by people like Jan Klatter... And then just stagings by Sebastian Niebling and of an English play, for Christ's sake. You know, it was like a play that we could have all seen at Edinburgh the next year anyway. And that was a much bigger eye-opener, because rather than thinking, oh, this is the, you know, this exciting new blah, blah thing, it's like, wow, these people have been doing all this work for a really long time. And the other thing was meeting my colleagues from everywhere else, and it was... really weird hearing them all talking the first time we all met in Munich, and everybody else had productions that they had all seen, you know, like if it was a Polish production of Cleansed, which was apparently amazing, and various other, you know, big European wide iconic works which they could all just talk about and go, oh yeah, this director, and I was like, we haven't had any of these people in Britain, and maybe we'd had one or two at the Edinburgh International Festival and another one or two at the Barbican, but they'd all seen work from each other's countries, more or less, it felt. They hadn't seen anything that had been going on in Britain, because we hadn't been exporting it, and we hadn't been importing it either. So it just felt like Britain was in this incredibly closed box, you know, and it was making its own work, and there was tons of stuff coming out. But it's not like I never sort of set out to sort of... try and stop everybody in Britain making all the work that was being made in Britain when I first went to Europe. It was just that it felt like we needed to expand and, you know, or open our eyes to all this other stuff as well. And it sounds monstrously arrogant, and I'm sure a ton of people had also seen it and probably felt the same, but no one else seemed to be writing about it, you know, at the time. And it didn't seem to be much of a reference point for anyone else.
So when I moved to Australia and I started going to a lot of theatre there, because there's actually a lot of theatre in Melbourne, more so than in any city that I'd lived in before, but I had seen a lot of theatre because I'd seen it, you know, it accumulates, I'd seen it in other places, I remember being very confused about what things meant. For example, you would have these big productions where the same actor would appear in different kind of situations, you know, he was someone's boyfriend and then suddenly he was delivering pizza, and I kind of remember thinking, oh, okay, so this is just this person playing multiple characters, but no, that was not the case. This was actually meant to be understood as this was the same character whose you know, fortunes had changed, and I just kind of remember thinking, this is really confusing. I did not assume that the character and the actor were, you know, insolubly bound. Why is this? This is what theatre is like.
I guess it is confusing because that's not always, I mean, it's not consistently the case in Australia that you don't ever have an actor double up.
Yeah. What I'm trying to say is that I found sort of these very, very strongly naturalistic productions very confusing because I didn't understand that that's what they were doing because I didn't expect them to do that.
Yeah. That's, I mean, it's probably quite a mild example. I mean, I can imagine, you know, somebody who's so used to seeing, you know, heavily director. I mean, obviously there are problems with saying director-led because it's collaborative. And I mean, the smart thing that a load of people keep saying at the moment is that Regie Theatre is basically actors' theatre. It's not the director. It's to do with like the improvisations and what the actors bring to the process. And actually the concept thing arrives.
The way we talk about it, which I think is quite apt, is we talk about stage metaphor. Stage having its own metaphor as opposed to being a literal representation of reality.
Yeah, I always wonder what it would be like to get a sort of really hardcore German theatre theoretician in to watch a load of the really hardcore naturalistic productions that still exist in Britain, but just tell them that it's all a concept. And they're not allowed to go, oh, you're just being British. You have to, they have to believe that it's a metaphor, and then how that would read. Because I'm sure there's actually some really kind of creative thinking. If we didn't all just go, it's just meant to, it just looks like a room that's meant to look like that, and actually thought about it more creatively, there's probably better ways we could understand what's going on. No, I think there's, you know, there is craft in the way that these things are put together, obviously, but craft and possibly not philosophy.
I mean, there are media theories, you know, that talk about representation of gender, representation of, you know, race, and the stories that get told, the sort of assumptions that get propagated and things like that. But that largely comes from media studies, from film, television, things like that.
Well, and from gender studies. And
And that is useful to some extent. But again, that's the sort of approach that just breaks down completely if you apply it to a non-naturalistic metaphorical.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, like the Three Kingdoms is obviously the example par excellence for that, because on one level you did have these people being metaphors, and at the same time, like Risto Kubar, who's the playing the white bird character creature, also turns up wearing a dress and also turns up as a dead body who could be a man or a woman, and he turns up wearing a dress and he could be actually a woman or he could be a bloke in a dress, and you don't really know. And that's not particularly pinned down. That performer is not in the script at all. They have no lines. They just sort of are extra textual. So it's just like a living metaphor completely for many, many, you know, a floating signifier as well. So on one level, it should have been impossible to have the argument, which did happen, about misogyny, because at the same time, there were observably only two women in the cast. And observably, it was a play about trafficked women who barely got a voice. So there was a certain amount of women playing silent, abused women, which, whilst also metaphorical, was also actually the thing that was happening. So, yeah, it's tricky. And there's also the other sort of end of representation, which has nothing to do with what the characters mean on stage, but who the actors are. You know, this is like employment representation. You know, if you're not employing anybody black or anybody who's a woman or anybody who's disabled or anybody who's over a certain age, then irrespective of the sort of unimpeachable intent of your metaphors, you've got a problem, because, you know, you're just propagating
terrible employment practices.
Well, also a view of, I mean, it's a bigger problem here, but this idea of neutrality, where, like, you know, basically a middle class white heterosexual man is neutral, you know, and everything else is a thing.
And you think that's a problem here in Germany?
Oh yeah, God. I mean, it's a problem that it's a problem they've only just started to realise they even have.
Because the white man is not necessarily going to play a white man, therefore it's okay. Because
on one level, the male female thing isn't maybe it's still problematic. I think there are less women on stage, fewer women on stage than there are men, and all the directors of that old school are still men. I was having an interesting conversation in Sweden with a German publisher, I think, who was saying Berlin theatre is so sexist. And you think, well, is it? And then you sort of look at the numbers and you think, well, I suppose actually institutionally speaking, it's not doing a brilliant job. But I guess, I mean, German society is slightly more monocultural than British. But there's, you know, the underrepresentation of Turkish people in Berlin until the Bauhaus Neumannstrasse people took over the Gorky was, you know, pretty catastrophic. And even so, that's kind of then localised all the representation to one theatre.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it feels like a thing that they could do something with, maybe.
Mm, that's maybe like a blind spot because of their practices, their staging practices.
Yeah.
Mm. I wanted to ask you about something else, and that's sort of the question of how different visibility of different kinds of theatre in different places, how history gets written from that. And you were talking about forced entertainment. And forced entertainment, I think if you live in continental Europe, you see a lot of forced entertainment. You know, they do a lot of work in very visible places, at very kind of big festivals. And I think a lot of work that happens in bigger theatres in the UK doesn't have that representation. You know, it's not considered to be interesting, and so it doesn't tour. And so forced entertainment sort of become a part of the history of theatre as it is told in Europe, but not necessarily in the UK.
Yeah.
And very interestingly, I was going through Post-Dramatic Theatre, Lehmann's book, just recently, and I think the only Australian group that's actually mentioned in it is Sydney Front. Now, Sydney Front, I would challenge you to find anyone in Melbourne that's actually heard of them.
Right.
They were active in the late 80s, early 90s, and Australia doesn't remember its theatre history, so these people are, they're not forgotten, but they sort of are. They're better known in Sydney, but not really outside of Sydney. But they are written down, you know, in this very important book as being a part of the history of theatre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I mean, it was something I thought about a lot when I wrote that chapter about theatre in the 2000s. And very consciously wanted to work against the only two extant big books on the subject, which were Michael Billington's State of the Nation, which goes up to, I think, 2007, maybe, and Alex Sirtz's Rewriting the Nation, which is just the study of new writing. Which is, so on one level, it's a book I have immense problems with, but on one level it's very unfair to condemn it for following its own brief, except that I think its own brief is so culpable that it does deserve condemnation. But as a result, I was really keen to try and talk about, in the same 60 pages, all the kind of experimentally live art kind of described work, the sorts of new plays that weren't new plays, you know, as like not capital letter N, capital W, new writing. Like verbatim theatre, which kind of some people just thought didn't count, but there was so much of it in the OOs, especially, that it seems insane not to consider it in the same breath as playwrights like David Edgar, David Eldridge, Dennis Kelly, you know, Lucy Kirkwood, Polly Stenham, and all these kind of royal court writers. There was that. And then at the same time, the authorship of directors like Rupert Gould and Katie Mitchell and like Ramin Grape, arguably, who would do classics. And, you know, it's this thing where you have all this Shakespeare being produced and all these Chekhovs and Greeks and whatever else. And it somehow drops out of most considerations of theatre history because it's not a new play, I mean, which is more or less entirely how it gets written about in Britain. So 50% of the stuff that's getting sort of put on stage by the National, or, you know, even more by the Almeida and the Young Vic, for example, which are putting on, it's all London theatres, sorry, everybody outside London. You know, all this work, which at the time, you know, is probably the best thing you saw in a month, possibly. Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly important. And it's being used to make a comment on the time. And yet no one really talks about the stagings because we don't talk about directors like that. So it's always through the new plays that we see what the theatre's about. So that's, I mean, that's just, that's another problem. That's not exactly what you asked, but...
No. It's very much what I've asked about, you know, how history gets written through a specific lens.
Yeah, and even, like, revivals and West End revivals, even in a really weird way, they're about to revive David Hare's play Skylight, which apparently won the 1996 Olivier Award. But nobody's ever going to write about that in a theatre history, whereas actually it's quite significant that that's what they're doing in a lot of ways. I mean, it tells you more about what people think other people are going to pay money for, and they can get the cash to make entirely from scratch, because it's not going to be subsidised at all. It's not a transfer from a subsidised house. It's just it's a commercial venture.
Something that I think is an important and interesting question, because unless you live in a place like Berlin or London in the UK, you know, or in one of these places that are real kind of centres of performing arts, like Paris, you're actually going to miss out on quite a lot of stuff. You know, you are going to miss out on the second most important Polish production of that year or something like that. You know, like, it's absolutely inevitable that in theatre you're not going to... You can't see everything, unlike, say, in film.
Yeah, no, film you can just catch up for more or less indefinitely.
Yeah.
Because it's on a DVD or something, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this is a particularly interesting question in a place like Australia, say, because Australia has these very big, important theatre directors that don't do work in Australia, they do it somewhere else. And their productions don't actually arrive. You know, like every fifth, say, Benedict Andrews production will make it to Australia, the other ones won't.
Mm.
And so every fifth one gets kind of written into the history, but with these massive gaps.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, it's interesting also, I guess, where the history counts. Yeah, if you've got a director like Katie Mitchell, who's, I think, who did make a domestic production last year, but made probably five or six bits of work elsewhere. And so does one try to include them because they're a British director? Or, like, you know, there's the infinite numbers of stagings of, like, Martin Crimp and Dennis Kelly and Simon Stevens plays. Do they count because they're a British playwright? I don't think it's particularly futile to limit a theatre history to a national border, although it's really interesting what then does and doesn't count within that. Yeah, no, I think the stories are going to be increasingly diffuse as the world gets, I don't know, more and more. People travel and everything gets more and more interconnected, but things like theatre don't take place at the same time. Although, that said, the best forced entertainment show, the only forced entertainment show I saw this year so far, was the 6-hour durational version of And on the Thousandth Night. And I watched that in Shrewsbury in my parents' house while they were performing it in Lyndon.
I saw that as well.
Yeah, yeah, of course you did. And you watched it in Melbourne.
Yes.
Yeah, and we all talked on Twitter at the same time.
That was a really beautiful experience.
It was, actually. it was great. But, what you know, in terms of where that lives in anybody's kind of experience. And also, I mean, this is another thing that I thought about that night especially, was that I think there was only one British person writing on that excellent blog. There was only Daniel Yates, who was a native Englishman. And the rest was like you, Boyana, and Deanna Damien, and Debbie Pearson, who's is Canadian. And half of you weren't writing in England. Most of you weren't English, and yet it's an English website and an English theatre company you're writing about performing in Lisbon. And it's, yeah, it kind of brought home to me the, on one hand, the complete level of futility about wanting everything to be identifiable as English or British or whatever. And also at the same time, if Englishness is a thing, then I think it's going to be defined now by that kind of hybridity.
But I think that the question of audience is where it becomes geographically specific, you know, because the audience, and the audience of course is always going to be much less educated than a theatre professional, because they, you know, they're not going to travel around the world watching theatre, even if they enjoy theatre.
Yeah.
And when you make a theatre show, half of the work is the audience, how it responds, what it perceives, things like that. I mean, you probably have had that experience of seeing the same show in a couple of different places and just feeling the audience respond very differently?
That's an interesting question. I'm trying to think of an example.
Well, I can give you an example of seeing Nature Theatre of Oklahoma. I don't know if you've seen their work.
I haven't.
beautiful American, very much sort of postmodern American, very, very specific in the question that they ask, you know. And I saw their work, No Dice. I saw it in Croatia 1 year, and then only about 5 months later, I saw it in Sydney.
Mm.
And Croatian audience, you know, being kind of Central European, had this very intellectual response to it. They were sort of going, wow, this is in the tradition of epic storytelling, blah, blah. The Sydney audience just thought it was really funny.
Yeah. It's interesting when both audiences like it, but in their own specific national ways. I mean, I've seen different productions of the same play is probably more true than actually the same production travelling. A really funny example. I did see a Lithuanian... They'd done a production of Jim Cartwright's play Road. I imagine they'd kind of appropriated it for Lithuanian purposes, but they hadn't changed any of the names, and it had English surtitles, happily, so I could keep up with what was going on. And just all these cultural references that, you know, are just like the most obvious thing in a British play, which was written in 1986 about the North of England in 1986, just had, for me, it's like that thing about a blind man drawing an elephant, or the three blind men drawing an elephant, and it's like, wow, you have no idea what this elephant actually looks like. Mm. So that, I mean, that was fascinating. But
you wrote about that in regards to Ostermeyer's production of Sarah Kane's Blasted once.
I might have done, yeah.
You wrote about... this was a production...
God, you remember my work better than I do.
I like your work, that's why. But you wrote about a production of Blasted by Ostermeyer that was in London. It came to London for whatever reason. And you said, very, very interesting, how the class difference
between
man and the woman, I forget their names, is completely gone.
Ian and Kane.
Because, of course, in Kane's original, it was very noticeable because of the way they spoke. And, of course, that would be quite lost in translation, and so it was simply not there in the stage.
Yeah.
And this is very interesting because it becomes about something else.
Yeah, and I at the time I thought, oh, is this a problem? Like, is this, have they just like fucked up the play? And it was. It took me. I mean, this was 2006, so I had no one had ever explained that Germans do theatre differently. So I thought they were doing the same thing, but not getting it right, which was it's always an embarrassing thing to have to admit. But yeah, no, that is fascinating. And but it's a problem that persists. I mean, I think it's something, you know, the English do it to Chekhov in that, you know, we don't... All these Russians that he writes about. I mean, for ages it was just like this, like, endless posh dinner party. And it was completely the English class system and nothing to do with Russia whatsoever.
But then at the same time, a British production of anything at all will be about class, because the British...
Well, yeah, it can't not be. That is an interesting problem. But then what was really interesting is seeing something like Wastwater. I mean, it's meant to be a naturalistic production with a slightly kind of metaphorical set, but it's basically by this big German naturalist, which I didn't know existed, but apparently there are some. And if it was naturalism, I just didn't understand really what milieu he was aiming at evoking. Again, they had English names, but no one in England has ever dressed or looked or behaved in the way that these people were. For the benefit of the people who haven't seen Wastwater, the second scene is set in a hotel room where this bloke is just about to start trying to have an affair with this woman, and like they've met at some party and they're both, you know, have other partners. And in the British production, the man is very, very nervous and the woman is quite sort of matter of fact and quite hardcore. And in this production, the man was completely relaxed and fine, despite having all the lines were present. But he was just delivering them like in this very cool German way. He was just like, yes, everything is fine. And the woman, she was played by Judith Rosmeyer, who's also Gertrude and Ophelia in the Thomas Ostermeyer Hamlet, is a staggeringly beautiful actress. And she's meant to be this kind of policewoman who had formerly been a heroin addict, and you sort of looked at her and you thought, you wouldn't really be much use in the police force, and you've never taken heroin in your life, but she's got, you know, got that hair that only actresses actually have in the real world, you know, it's just kind of like phew. And you just think, wow, this is very strange. This is like for naturalism, this is some of the least detailed kind of character work I've ever seen in my life. What's going on?
But the production still felt legitimate?
It felt well meant. I don't think it worked. But But it was an interesting thing to see it kind of being approached really weirdly from the other direction, because I kind of whine about English directors not being able to do German plays very well. But it was interesting to see a German director kind of really failing to grasp the specifics of an English play, but also not in a way that was trying to, you know, it wasn't replacing them with something else, and it wasn't a concept thing, and it wasn't like they hadn't hacked the text about and made their own dialectic or something. They'd just done a naturalistic play with a sort of naturalism that didn't seem to correlate to anything that I would have expected. I mean, it was broadly there, but it was kind of, I think the fact that it was so broadly there was probably why the bits where it didn't kind of cohere suddenly felt really fascinating.
I want to go back to the question that you asked me when we were just talking about having this conversation, and you said, why do Australian directors get more work in Germany than British directors? I thought it was a really interesting question. I don't know that it's true, though. Do you think it is?
Well, I mean, if I can't remember the name of the one that you first mentioned.
Not Benedict Andrews.
No. But then there's Benedict Andrews, who's done very, very well here, and Barry Kosky, who runs Commission Opera, so
yes,
that's doing pretty well as well. I mean, we haven't got anything comparable. I mean, there are a couple of younger English directors who may, you know, arrive, and, you know, people who are doing okay here, but not on the same level as, like, directing main stage Sherbourne and stuff, except Katie Mitchell. But she feels like a different case.
But these people are also a different case in Australia,
okay, yeah,
you know. And I think this is a very interesting question, because I never thought of it that way, you know. And I suspect that some of it has to do with the fact that Australia feels to itself like a peripheral culture, you know, on the periphery of something. And usually this is understood to be London because of the very strong historical connection between the two countries. But you also have to keep in mind that Australia is a recent immigrant society. You know, Barry Kosky is from a German-Jewish family, I believe.
Oh, okay. Right.
You know, his family moved to Australia. I don't actually know this for a fact, but I think it was his grandmother.
Right.
That was the migrating generation. And so someone like that will naturally gravitate towards Europe, but not necessarily to London.
No, yeah.
You know, he will gravitate towards Vienna.
Ooh.
And he did work in Vienna for a long time. So those are the sort of, that's the sort of peculiarity there. And I really do think that Australian theatre artists are a little bit humbler in the sense that they don't think that what happens in their backyard is the really most important thing in the universe, the way that it sometimes feels British.
Yeah, no, well, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think some Brits really do believe that, and others are kind of a bit more, you know. I mean, there is that line, it's like British theatre is the best in the world, that gets trotted out at us, you know, with surprising regularity, and some people kind of just feel warmed by that, and some people just sort of sit there with a big sort of question mark sort of in neon above their head going, really does anyone else say this?
But the lines of influence, you know, are what's really quite interesting in these conversations, because, of course, any national theatre, however vaguely we define it, picks its influences selectively, and it's often based on chance.
Yeah.
You know, so in Australia, or in Melbourne specifically, there's a number of directors that have gone to Germany, that have done quite well, or even if they didn't, they receive their formative influences over there,
yeah,
over here rather, and then they go back to Australia and then they make work. And after a while, the audience actually learns to understand,
yeah,
what is happening. The same way in which there has been that transfer of sensibility from, I think, the US to the UK that created live art. And then live art becomes a part of the British story.
Yeah. And I think also, this is going to sound mad and perverse, especially given so many other things I've argued, but I think Britain's got some things which it might always end up doing to anything that comes over. Like, especially to do with the sense of humour and the way the language works, is that it was really interesting to see Joe Hill Gibbons's Edward II, because they did that what I think of as being quite a cast off polish gobsquaddy kind of video back room. So you've got like a closed room which has only got video cameras inside it to which project it onto this, what project what's happening inside there onto a screen either in front of the box or above the stage or whatever. And what was really interesting about seeing it done with British actors on a British stage with a British text, but like a technique that's kind of I associate most with Germany, was that it suddenly took on a whole new life and like turned into British TV, and actually worked quite well as British TV, and everybody was being quite funny and also being funny in close-up rather than doing stage funny, which is different. And that was really, I think if there'd been more of that acknowledgement of the fact that Britain doesn't have anything like a comparable philosophical tradition or understanding to Germany, like you can't put something on stage, I think, at the National, and the explanation you offer to the paying audience is, oh well, it's about its dialectics, you know, in the way that you can in it feels in Germany in a state theatre, you can say, oh well, it's dialectics, and the majority of the audience have been trained in some way of thinking or linguistically are predisposed to understand that, whereas, you know, in Britain that will get you well fired, I would imagine. I go, oh, it's fine, it's dialectics, and then go, no, that's not fine.
No, but it's interesting that the use of video in, I don't know, I grew up with video being used on stage all the time, and by the time that I was old enough to go see theatre, this has already, I think, moved away from being something about, you know, the mediatization of the world, which just became a trope, something because it's done. But in Australia, it's not done, and it still isn't done, except Benedict Andrews does it. And the reason why it's not done is that most of the really inventive theatre in Australia is independent, and so it's poorly funded, so they simply don't have video cameras and screens lying around to be used.
Although it's getting cheaper. It was really interesting thinking about the technology in my chapter, because at the beginning of the OOs, barely anyone had a mobile phone. And by the end of the OOs, everybody had a phone that could make videos, pretty much, you know, as standard with their contract. And like the whole Skype on stage data projectors got really cheap. I mean, like you can get one for, what, 500 euros now, probably less. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, they were like a couple of thousand quid, and only main houses could afford something so lavish. And in fact, I think they rented them. So, yeah, I mean, as technology all kind of decreases in cost, that's, you know, another... It's really interesting how much that kind of material factor really is much more important than anyone ever gives it credit for. Mm. Like the cost of flights to Germany going down, the cost of technology just plummeting all the way through the decade.
I agree with you. But there is a funny kind of misreading that happens then, because, as I said, in Australia, the use of video cameras is very strongly associated with Benedict Andrews.
Which
always makes me laugh, you know, because it's just not. Like, I understand that he works in an environment where this is just something that you do,
of course.
And then, you know, someone will review one of his few productions in Australia and say, oh, you know, this is typical Andrews with his cameras. Mm. And to me, it basically opens up the question of who is Benedict Andrews conversing with when he makes this particular work?
That's an interesting question.
Why is he using it, and what is he trying to communicate to the audience?
Mm.
Because he knows what audience he's dealing with to a large extent.
Yeah, it's not like you forget. Yeah. Oh, but unless you're Thomas Ostermeyer or Romeo Castellucci, in which case you know that whatever piece you're making is probably going to end up in unforeseen places, playing in front of, I don't know, maybe the educated theatre fanatic audience or theatre expert audience primarily that you get at international festivals. and at the Barbican, I guess, and mm-hmm. or in whichever. I mean, where did they play the whichever Ostermeyer went to Australia? Like any of the people went mm-hmm. to.
Mm. Played it in the art centre, played in the biggest possible place that it could.
In Melbourne?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But, you know, I suppose that's the sort of problem that you just don't have in the UK, because the English, let's not call it British, let's call it English, culture is so big. It's big to itself, it's big to everyone else. You know, it, not in the sense of necessarily being rich in every aspect, but just in the sense of having that importance to itself.
That question of who you're playing to in Britain is a very different question because of the multiculturalism and the class system, is that theatre makers are, I mean, you know, basically there's a thing where you can probably sell out most theatre to white middle class people forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem, you know, because there could be a degree of complacency where you can just go, well, these are the people, and in 90% of cases it feels like these are the people because they're also my people, because I am also white and middle class, and that's why I'm making theatre for these other white middle class people who are my friends. And, you know, I mean, that's a subject of, I mean, I'm obviously the least well placed person in the entire universe to discuss this from any kind of outsider perspective, but it's, I mean, it's something that everyone's acutely conscious of, but while everybody who's acutely conscious of it remains white, privileged, and, I mean, male, maybe not so much, and heterosexual doesn't seem to be as much of an issue anymore. But whilst everybody's, like, so many people are privileged and white, I think it's very difficult for those people to be representative of anything else. So the only real way they can effect a proper change is by standing back and letting somebody who isn't them do it, really. It's like, I mean, you can be the most understanding, privileged white male running the National Theatre out there, and I think we've just got the most understanding, privileged white male who's going to run the National Theatre, but at the same time, he's still a privileged white male. So, you know, no matter how many people they bring in behind them, they're still in charge. So there's that kind of big elephant in the room going, well, it's nice that you're making the effort, but it's still you making the effort.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had a very interesting experience watching an Untreueren Kud show in Sydney at Sydney Theatre Company, which is the big theatre in Sydney. And this was one where you have to vote. And so everyone was given a thing to...
Fight Night?
Yes, Fight Night. Everyone was given a little gadget to vote with, and in the beginning, probably to test the equipment, we sort of had to give a few stats
to ourselves. Yeah.
You know, are you male or female? How much do you... What's your age? And also how much you earn?
Mm.
And very, very interestingly, it turned out that there was no one in the middle. The audience was almost entirely populated by students, possibly high school students, because there were quite a few people that were under the age of 18, and people older than, I think, 65. And the same thing applied to income. Just about everyone in that audience either earned below minimum salary.
The artists.
Or had the annual salary of 130,000 a year.
I don't know what that means in...
It's maybe about 100,000 euros a year.
Right,
or more, like a lot of money.
That's a lot of money, yeah.
Very, very unrepresentative of Australia as a whole. And it's very interesting because, you know, that probably happens all the time in theatre in Australia, but you never see it spelled out on a really big screen in front of you. You know, and suddenly I had this moment of thinking, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, like, what are we representing here? We are not representing society. The way that I feel when I see a show in Germany, I feel like this is the society and we are watching.
It depends on the theatre. I mean, Volksbühne, I feel it maybe a bit more than anywhere else. Like, the people there genuinely seem like they could be working class Berliners who go to the theatre because they feel a real affinity with that building. And multiple ages. You know, I mean, the most, I guess, absent demographic is actually, you know, people with small children. And, you know, there's a reason that they're not in the theatre for a while. But yeah, no, it was interesting. I saw Fight Night in Edinburgh, and I think the salary was very low. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that we refer to ourselves as privileged in that way, because actually there's so little money being made by artists and by people at my level, at least, of writing about it. Like, the, yeah, there are external factors like having middle-class parents who are, you know, all that stuff. But the actual money you make yourself can be spectacularly low. I mean, you know, if I had any sense, I'd stop it. I'd become a tube driver. Mm. I'd probably quadruple my salary.
But what I mean is, if the audience changes so much from place to place, the work of art that you're presenting also changes enormously, because the audience responds in a different way. The feeling in the room is very different. People will laugh at different places, at different jokes. You know, there will be a level of hostility in one place that another place just won't have. And if you are making a political, say, work, and you know, that's sort of the definition of political art, is that you're trying to mobilize people, right? Mm. I mean, that's kind of the definition of political art.
Or just commenting on politics, perhaps.
Yeah, but it's meant to have a certain transformative effect. Then it simply changes with the audience very much.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. That play, King Charles III, which is at the Almeida, you know, for my money, I think it's very cleverly written, and it does some interesting and intelligent things, and I think it has quite a bleak perspective on where Britain is politically. But I think it's also playing at a very sort of nice theatre in a nice part of town, which has, you know, wealthy patrons. You know, it's the local theatre to some people with some serious amounts of money. So I've talked to other friends who weren't there on press night, and press night was very nice because it was me and a load of people I know who are roughly my contemporaries, and none of us paid for tickets. So, and then they gave us food and drink afterwards, which was very nice. But people who are going and seeing it with a normal paying Almeida audience, I think, are finding it much more alienating, because those people are laughing possibly at the jokes in a different way, or possibly at the entire thing in a different way. And I think it's capable of supporting that audience as well, which is arguably clever. But it's interesting quite how divergent people's opinions of the play have been, I think, largely down to audience. Now, it's happened to me as well. You know, you go and see something which you either like, and you can see what it's trying to do, and then you have a load of people who are just determined to find it very, very funny, because that's how they feel most comfortable watching theatre. You know, they've gone to be entertained and blah, blah, blah. And so your good hard think is being, you know, interrupted by gales of laughter from everybody else in the building, and you're just like, argh. And maybe that, you know, they're obviously the majority, and they're probably therefore right, but
But your perception of the work changes, doesn't it?
Yeah. You actually, an audience can make you hate some work that you might otherwise have liked, I think.
Yeah.
It can do.
I've seen work that perhaps was trying to be very politically provocative, but the audience just insisted on taking it as one big joke.
Mm.
And it really diminishes my opinion of the work.
Although I guess maybe if it can be hijacked like that, maybe there's something to be said for thinking less of it, for not being able to resist that approach. I don't know.
But I think it makes an interesting point about transferring work, or rather theatre travelling to different places and always becoming a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting with Chris Thorpe's play, because actually the majority, I think, of the Germans I spoke to, and certainly of the German reviews I've read, really weren't into it. And they were, you know, in quite unexpected ways. And I think partly it's because of the politics around the Stuttgart, which has had its remit changed this year. So all three people were basically guinea pigs, and probably it had been put rather unfairly in a firing line that they didn't even know existed. But, yeah, no, it was really interesting to see a play which had been pretty much universally acclaimed, and everyone was kind of nodding along with in Britain, going, yeah, this is intelligent, smart bit of writing, perfectly good production, to people really questioning more or less every aspect of it. I'm interested to know how much maybe the production did things here which people read very differently to how they read them in England. Because in a way, it felt like, in Britain, it felt like quite a kind of European style piece. And as soon as we were watching it here, it really didn't. Like, it suddenly felt like, oh, oh no, this is very English. And that was really interesting to experience as a kind of thing where you thought you had something pretty much down, and then you're going, oh right, oh they're not buying this. That's interesting. I mean, I thought it was great, but it was also slightly different production. It felt different to how it had felt in Edinburgh and London. Partly, I think, because everybody who was doing it was really a bit really wired and nervous in a way that I don't think they had been halfway through a run in a small venue in Edinburgh, which, you know, they're completely comfortable doing it. Whereas this was kind of like, oh my God. So as a result, I think it came across as a lot more kind of intense. And I think that I really responded to that. But I think a lot of the Germans in the audience really, the thing that they wanted least was intensity, in a way. They would have been much happier if it had been much more calm and tons more abstract. I mean, emailed a friend and they had a really interesting exchange about how they would have maybe directed it differently. And it was such a kind of additional pile of concept, which would have, I think, yeah, could, they've accurately identified how it would have brought out different qualities in the text, which would have worked more well here. But it is interesting when it feels like there's sort of different degrees of hand-holding that all the audiences need for something to feel kind of acculturated to them. And it's the first time I'd really experienced it happening to Germans. Like, the sort of same sense of, like, Michael Billington-style outrage that we get in Britain when they don't do things properly. And they're like, what? Well, you haven't done this properly. And this German response really was just kind of like, you haven't done this like the Germans would at all. And you're like, no, we're English. And part of me wished that somebody had run with it and tried to work out what the English thing was that was going on there, rather than just being quite superior about it. But not everybody was like that. You know, the editor of Theater Heute liked it. That seems to be a good thing. But it was really interesting to talk to all these people.
Do you think that as professional critics, you know, we travel a bit more than the audience, it's not necessarily more than the artists, but certainly more than the audiences, and we see work in a lot of places. And
although that's new, I mean, that's quite unusual for professional critics.
That's true.
I mean, most British critics are pretty much pinned to London, and maybe a few, like Michael Billington, for example, stays in London, except when there's a really big regional stage opening. You know, and he doesn't, more or less, doesn't get to travel.
No, that's actually really true. I don't have, my question was entirely wrong, because one of the big problems in Australia is that theatre critics there just do not travel at all, because they can't, because their jobs, like critics in London, probably their jobs simply require them to be in a certain locality all the time.
Yeah.
And so they become uninformed.
Well, it's different sorts of information, isn't it? I mean, you know, Lynn Gardner sees work up and down the country in Britain, and a certain amount of, I guess, touring international work that comes here, and must have an encyclopedic knowledge of certain sorts of things. But yeah, I can't take a week off and go to Germany and see half of Theater Treffen. And they can read about it, but reading about theatre is a weirdly incomplete experience, you know, in a way that...
In a way that reading about...
Well, no, because reading about other things is similarly incomplete, but it wouldn't be the whole experience, because if you read about it, then you can usually get hold of it as well. Yeah. Like, it's probably on YouTube, whatever else it is. Or even a poor representation of a picture, like an artwork, painting or something, can be found probably on Google. It might not be the same as standing in front of a whole wall's worth of the same painting, but you at least see what it looks like. Whereas, because most productions aren't filmed, so you just get the trailers, and even those, even when they're really good, aren't really going to give you... I mean, I'm talking myself out of my entire job here, which I do think is, you know, trying to describe things as for people who aren't there and aren't going to get to see it, as much as having a sort of discussion with people who have seen it.
Have you ever seen a work of theatre that you thought was just brilliant and it changed your entire perception of theatre, and now you realise that you just understood it wrong?
I don't think that's happened. Partly, I think, because it's very hard to get your perception of something changed too much after the event. That's not really true. But you know what I mean? It's like the idea of having got it wrong, that would have to come out of some sort of really hardcore discussion, which often doesn't seem to be still perversely available. Also, at that point, I think I'd just decide that I was right. Even if it wasn't what they meant, then I'd just go, wow, that was a life-changing experience. That's good for me. I don't care that that wasn't what they meant. Because you've still had that experience. So, like, I'm going to see... Oh, God. I'm going to see... no, not see. Participate in this Belgian thing. And we're going to be talking about a piece of work we haven't seen that doesn't exist. And that conversation is going to be recorded, and that's going to be the piece of work. But it's going to be a different piece of work, obviously. And all the sort of backgroundy stuff that we're all... So we all have stuff that we can discuss in common, is made by a group who I saw once in Estonia. And they're a French-Swiss group or something.
Superman.
Yeah.
Austrian.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
They're French as well, though, right?
French-Austrian, I think.
Okay. And I hate their work. Well, if they're Austrian, it explains everything.
You wrote about them, I remember. I remember you said it feels like they're banging their heads against their own for some reason.
Mm-hmm. And in the middle of this pack that we've been sent, they even have a CD featuring a discussion by critics making more or less all those points, so it's nice to know I'm not alone. But they've got now they've got this sort of line of postmodern defence where it's like they've already got the criticism and that's the point, and then it's just like it's so endlessly circuitous. And so, yeah, I do kind of not wake up with a cold sweat, but do wonder about things like that, where it's like, have I got it wrong, or have I are they just idiots? And I'm sure it's a bit of both, but that's something where, and now I'm being forced to return to this work again, not the same piece but more of the same, and that's going to be quite an interesting experience, I think, because if their point is that they're being deliberately boring or deliberately irritating and whatever, then obviously finding it boring and irritating is basically the only possible response, because that's how they've made the work and that's what the work is. But then if you're meant to kind of then credit them with having done something...
Mm-hmm.
Like, aha, congratulations, you've really blown my mind by boring me senseless and making me very angry. Exactly as you intended, your work has succeeded, it operates in the precise function, you know, it operates in the precise way that you anticipate it working. Why would you want to do that to me? Oh, because the world's a bad place, and now, you know, now we understand that the world's a bad place a bit better because we've been bored and irritated by a theatre company.
Yeah, it reminds me of something else that you said. I clearly know your work too well. But in one of your workshops, this is one of the early, I think, critic workshops there.
Yeah.
You went to, I think this was in Ljubljana, and you were talking about seeing a show that you thought was incredibly bad. And then afterwards, in a discussion with other critics, you had...
It was in Helsinki, but the critic was from Ljubljana.
Rocco, what's his name?
Rock Viva.
Yeah. And you said he spoke so beautifully about all of his themes in the work, and he was sort of quoting Žižek and whatnot, and then you sort of felt like it was all good and fine, but was it a good work? Mm. Are we allowed to talk about that? Isn't that sort of... Is that your English kind of...
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I was talking to this guy from Theater Heute, and he was talking about this the guy who taught him about criticism, and he was saying, you know, they did just write down all the things that had happened, and I've been noticing it a lot about all the reviews that have been around the work here, is that it's often very hard to discern an opinion, because it's very, well, I mean, calling it fact-based seems a bit like I don't like or appreciate it, but it's a very different critical culture, and it's not necessarily one that I'm particularly taken with, actually. I mean, it's weird, because obviously on one level I hate star ratings and blah blah blah, but I quite like the frankness of English critics when they're just going, well, I don't like it, and they can carry on describing it for a lot longer, but it's like it's quite nice to have that sense of a perspective of the person who was sat in the theatre and who was having a reaction to the work, rather than just being this kind of brain in an unfeeling box, just kind of going, yes, these dialectics are like this. And you kind of go, right, did you enjoy yourself? It is immaterial, the question is not a question. I'm like, no, go on. what's it like to actually watch? And go, oh, it's hell, but with my enormous brain.
I suppose the theatre here reflects that sort of critical culture, or the critical culture reflects the theatre.
Oh, I don't know. I would imagine...
Well, it's a very unfeeling theatre, isn't it?
That's arguably true. Although, I don't know, I mean, I probably make massive category errors by watching as an English person, just sort of, you know, responding to it probably quite Englishly and, you know, finding things funny and moving or whatever. I'm sure in ways that I'm not intended to, but that's another interesting thing is, you know, you can't stop people watching theatre as they are wont to do. I mean, maybe you can think up new strategies for watching things, but it's interesting where and where not that stuff happens, because I've definitely come out of stuff with mixture of various European critics from across Europe, and we've all just gone, oh, it's awful. You know, and that there's no amount of cultural difference where we've all just, you know, just gone, oh, that was a fucking catastrophe. And none of us have, I mean, A, it's interesting that none of us liked it, but B, that no one was going, ah, you know, think about the dialectics.
We'll continue to explore the question of responsibility in the next episode. So you can find us on iTunes or through our website at audiostage.guerrillasemiotics.com.